We begin with a brief, very brief article out of American Free Press. It's called Bloody Irony. In 1965, the U.S. Army released a manual on how to build and hide booby traps, replete with detailed diagrams illustrating means of wiring detonators to explosives. It also provided advice on the best locations for concealing the deadly bombs along roadways and buildings. 2 decades later, reports Reuters, the Iraqi military issued its troops an Arabic version of the same army manual. Now the manual has been turning up in the hands of guerrilla forces fighting the United States in Iraq. What goes around comes around. Sometimes the shortest commentaries are the best. The following is a satirical commentary on the very real likelihood that just before leaving office, King George W. Bush will issue blanket pardons to everyone in his administration, including himself. This is a takeoff on Alice in Wonderland. It's by David Swanson, published by SmirkingChimp.com, and entitled Unlimited Pardon Power and Five Other Impossible Things Before Breakfast. He could have called it Alice in Pardonland. When Alice emerged from the rabbit hole, she found that her family and all of the townspeople she'd known had been slaughtered by White House staffers following the instructions of the president. The murderers didn't face a trial because the president simply pardoned them before anyone even had a chance to suggest it. But wait, said Alice, how can he pardon people for crimes he told them to commit? Once he's done that, there are no more crimes and no more laws. So there must then be no more pardons. Alice was overheard making this exclamation by a creature stranger than any she'd ever encountered before, a creature called a lawyer. The lawyer explained that the president's pardon power was unlimited. The lawyer knew this to be so because no court had ever limited the president's pardon power. Alice asked the lawyer his name 5 times before understanding that it was John Yoo. Yoo told Alice that she had much to be thankful for. First of all, said Yoo, we killed everyone while you were away. Second of all, we've united the land, or what's left of it. All the lawyers agreed about unlimited pardon powers. Why shouldn't we? We're the ones needing the pardons. And there you have David Swanson's opinion on presidential pardons. In line with that commentary, we have this one on presidential pardons. This one's by Michael Collins, also writing in Smirking Chimp. End presidential pardons and clemency. An amendment. The president shall not have the right to pardon or clemency. The prospect of the criminal-in-chief, George W. Bush, issuing pardons to his co-conspirators is repugnant to all citizens who paid any degree of attention over the last 8 years. He neglected his duty prior to 9/11, resulting in a devastating attack on the nation. He started an illegal war based on lies that caused injury and death to tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers and the deaths of over 1.2 million Iraqi civilians. He ordered the illegal wiretapping of citizens, a clear violation of law. He stopped scientific research, causing the suffering unto death of those with illnesses and injury that could have been healed during his term. The list goes on and on. Bush ruled like a tyrant, with the wisdom of an adolescent sociopath. Right now, this man, who should have been impeached and subsequently jailed for his crimes, is planning last-minute pardons and acts of clemency for his friends, co-conspirators, and others who met his deviant criteria for release from legal obligations. Highly motivated citizens and legislators are seeking legal precedents and rationales to stop Bush from pardoning his collaborators. Hopefully their efforts, one of which is impeachment, will meet with success, allowing those who attack the people to walk away free after the death, destruction, and ruin they've caused will deny meaning to any efforts aimed at true reform. The problem of presidential pardons goes well beyond George W. Bush's ability to issue them. The absolute right of presidents to pardon any crime is archaic, arbitrary, and offensive to those who value human dignity, rationality, and the rule of law. Pardons and clemency emerged from tyranny and the divine right to rule. Roman Emperor Nero fiddled while Rome burned and executed his relatives. As emperor, Caligula showed his contempt for Rome by torturing citizens and appointing a horse to the Senate. Rome formalized the shift from a republic to an imperial state when Julius Caesar was elevated above all by the Senate. This allowed him to accumulate vastly expanded powers, even though he was a first amongst equals. The fiction of the Roman Republic remained, but Julius Caesar and those who followed had extraordinary authority over policy and state action. The emperor even had the power to arbitrarily overrule the decision of tribunes of the people and magistrates. While Rome claimed to bring civilization to those it subdued, it was ultimately a lawless state, given the powers usurped by the emperors. No citizen was safe if he or she offended the first amongst equals. No decision by the people meant anything if the emperor's needs got in the way. Roman dictatorship was replaced in Europe by hereditary royalty, with the exception of the Republic of Venice. During the Middle Ages, these rulers, by accident of birth and raw power, generated the notion of the divine right of monarchs. Subjects were to believe that God flawlessly conferred the right of kings to rule. With a divine franchise, monarchs were able to determine who was arrested, tried, and convicted whenever it suited them. They were the state. These rulers had the absolute right to say who was and was not tortured and executed. There was some resistance to the notion of the divine right. Shakespeare echoed this in Richard III when the Duke of Lancaster comments on Richard's crimes. That England was wont to conquer others hath made a shameful conquest of itself. The first English Civil War represented a full break with the assertion of divine conferred rule. The conflict pitted the English middle class against the self-absorbed monarch, William I, and his supporters. The army fighting the king was one of the first in history to openly debate policy and political structure in the midst of war. Agitator John Wildman, the son of a butcher, drafted the Agreements of the People, the original transcripts of the debate, and agitator and trooper Edward Sexby, who with Wildman led the debate on behalf of radical democracy. The Putney debates involved Oliver Cromwell on one side and the Levellers faction of the army on the other. The army proposed a new government based on a universal male franchise, strict proportional representation, and punishment for King William for his crimes. They also specified the equality of citizens before the law without exception. Quote, that in all laws made or to be made, every person may be bound alike, and that no tenure, estate, charter, degree, birth, or place do confer any exemption from the ordinary course of legal proceedings wherein others are subjected. Close quote. That was an agreement of the people written in 1647. Cromwell prevailed against radical democracy, but the ideas didn't die. The American Revolutionary War was inspired in part by the political descendants of the Levellers. The outcome was compromised, to a degree, by the retention of the artifact of divine rule, the absolute right to pardon criminals of all sorts. As a result of the recent collapse of legislative balance against tyranny and cloaked as executive prerogative, much like the Romans suffered, we have a deviant leader with the power to negate what's left of our most important laws with a stroke of a pen. Bush negated legislation he disliked by issuing signing statements, indicating his intent to ignore laws he didn't care for. He will soon negate the history of his crimes by pardoning those who collaborated in the nation's conquest of itself, thus voiding any remainder of individual and collective protections. Bush should be denied this power. But the issue isn't confined to Bush. It's about the ability of each citizen to expect equal treatment by the law, and for all citizens to know in no uncertain terms that no one is above the law. Election to the presidency is not elevation to a divine status. It should not be taken as a right to unilaterally declare war, torture, lie, and steal, nor should it turn into a right to allow others to do the same without impunity. The Constitution should be amended to end this arbitrary and offensive practice now and forever. An amendment to the Constitution of the United States. The President shall not have the right to grant pardons or clemency. If such thoughts motivate you, you might want to contact your elected representatives with how you feel on the issue of rights to pardon or clemency and the possibility of having an amendment to the Constitution. My commentary for today, 10th of December. Well, the great state of Illinois has produced another politician of note. The president-governor, Rod Blagojevich, was elected to replace the previous governor, who's presently doing 6 years in jail for graft. Not to be outdone by his predecessor, the new governor has been under investigation for the past 3 years for alleged hiring fraud. But in a truly outlanding feat of chutzpah, he blatantly attempted to auction off the Senate seat vacated by Barack Obama. Here's just a smidgen of the reportage. Quote, Federal investigators bugged the governor's campaign offices and tapped his home phone, capturing conversations laced with profanity and tough guy talk. The Chicago FBI chief said even seasoned investigators were stunned by what they heard, particularly since the governor had known for at least 3 years he was under investigation for alleged hiring fraud and clearly realized agents might be listening in. Close quote. You gotta love a guy who knows the feds are probably wiretapping his phone and talks about his illegal plans anyway. Way to go, Gov. Next item. A letter to the editor of the Grass Valley Union had an incredibly brilliant suggestion. Why not have the major oil companies bail out the American automotive industry? After all, the oil giants made record profits, partially from the gas guzzlers produced by the idiots in Detroit. The more I think about it, the more brilliant the idea is. Place your bets on whether Congress will ever entertain this idea. Next item. This from American Freedom Campaign. If this issue interests you, tell Congress to pass a Pardons Disclosure Act to prevent President Bush from issuing secretive blanket pardons to members of his administration. For 8 years, we've been forced to sit by helplessly as President George W. Bush and top members of his administration eviscerated the Constitution, broke federal laws, and defied the will of Congress. Now Bush is poised to give each and every one of his accomplices, from Dick Cheney to Karl Rove to Alberto Gonzalez, a full pardon, ensuring that they will never receive the punishment they richly deserve for their activities. Worse, Bush may issue a preemptive blanket pardon covering all officials within his administration without disclosing either the names of the officials involved or the crimes for which they're being absolved. Congress can, however, stop this most objectionable action before it occurs. The American Freedom Campaign has proposed a Pardons Disclosure Act, which would force the president to specifically name any political appointees for whom pardons are granted, along with the crime or crimes for which they're being pardoned. Please tell your representatives in Congress to support a Pardons Disclosure Act by contacting www.salsa.democracyinaction.org. For those of you interested, www.salsa.democracyinaction.org. Next item. Now, here is a truly innovative form of protest, Dateline San Francisco. Since California voters approved Proposition 8 last month and repealed the right of gay couples to marry, initiative opponents have marched, held rallies, and blocked intersections. Today, they're asked to do something completely different. Nothing at all. Modeled loosely after the 2006 immigrant rights demonstration, Day Without a Gay is billed as a nationwide strike and economic boycott. If you're interested in more information, the website is www.jointheimpact.com. This is an organizational site for supporters of same-sex marriage. The idea today is for those who can afford to call in gay and instead spend the day doing volunteer work. However, the organizers fully recognize that in the present economic hard times, many people might want to participate but fear losing their hard-to-find jobs. The name was coined by Sean Hetherington, a personal trainer and comedian in West Hollywood, who added the idea of doing volunteer work rather than pursuing civil disobedience or other tactics. The website he created for this event, www.daywithoutagay.org, also offers a list of activities for people who don't feel able to walk off their jobs. So if you're interested in how you can support this, www.daywithoutagay.org. For those interested in how our government really works and why it doesn't seem to matter which political party is in power, this article might be of interest. It's published by smirkingchimp.com. It's by Robert Perry. He calls it The Significance of Nixon's Treason. You might have thought that when audio tapes were recently released of President Lyndon Johnson accusing Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign of treason for sabotaging the Vietnam peace talks as 500,000 U.S. troops sat in a war zone, the major U.S. media would be all over it, providing insight and context. If you thought that, of course, you'd be wrong. Instead, the story last week out of Johnson's presidential library received only cursory attention in the big newspapers and TV outlets, mostly references to a brief Associated Press wire story that treated the disclosure more as a curiosity than a clue to a dark historical mystery. The U.S. news media's blasé reaction may be almost as revealing as the tapes themselves, in that it reflects an institutionalized disinterest, even hostility, to sharing with the American people some ugly realities about their democracy when national security intersects with politics. In effect, the 1968 case, in which Nixon's operatives undermined President Johnson's desperate bid to end the Vietnam War, and thus helped ensure Nixon's election victory over Vice President Hubert Humphrey, may have been the original October surprise. A dozen years later, some of the veterans of Nixon's 1968 campaign were linked to a similar operation by the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign to interfere with President Jimmy Carter's negotiations to free 52 hostages held hostage in Iran, another Democratic failure that paved the way to a Republican victory. Regarding both cases, the Washington Press Corps mostly has looked the other way. Weaving through both historical mysteries is a common thread of the Washington establishment's professed fear that revealing too much about how the Republicans won those pivotal elections would harm the country. Speaking to that point, in 1968 was a pillar of the establishment, then Defense Secretary Clark Clifford. He joined with Secretary of State Dean Rusk in urging President Johnson not to go public with his evidence of Republican treachery. Quote, "Some elements of the story are so shocking in their nature that I'm wondering whether it would be good for the country to disclose the story and then possibly have a certain individual, Nixon, elected." Clifford said this in a November 4, 1968 conference call. "It could cast his whole administration under such doubt that I think it would be inimical to our country's interests." Clifford's remarks came in the context of Johnson learning that Christian Science Monitor reporter Saville Davis was working on a story about how Nixon's entourage had undermined the peace talks by sending its own messages to South Vietnamese officials. Instead of helping Davis confirm his information, Clifford and Rusk, who are both Democrats, by the way, argued that the Johnson administration should make no comment, advice that Johnson accepted. He maintained his public silence on what he regarded as the Nixon campaign treason, going into retirement privately embittered about the Republican sabotage. On November 8th of that year, Johnson recounted the evidence to Nixon himself and described the Republican motivation to disrupt the talks. "They've been quoting you, Nixon, indirectly, that the thing they ought to do is just not show up at any peace conference and wait until you come into office. Now they've started that boycott, and that's bad. They're killing Americans every day. I have that story of the sabotage documented. There's not any question, but it's happening. That's the story, Dick, and it's a sordid story. I don't want to say that to the country because it's not good." Faced with Johnson's implied threat to go public, Nixon promised to tell the South Vietnamese officials to reverse themselves and join the peace talks. However, the die was cast. Johnson was unable to achieve the breakthrough he'd hoped for before leaving office. The U.S. participation in the Vietnam War continued for more than 4 years at a horrendous cost to both the United States and the people of Vietnam. Before the conflict was finally brought to an end, 1 million or more Vietnamese were estimated to have died, along with an additional 20,000 U.S. dead and 111,000 U.S. wounded. The war dividend divided the United States, turning parents against their own children. The bitterness over the war also led to more abuses by President Nixon, who routinely cited national security to justify a massive political spying operation against his local enemies. The story goes on in detail about Nixon's eventual downfall over Watergate, but I'll leave it at that. And the bottom line to this is Nixon's operatives went to the South Vietnamese and said, "Don't join the peace talks. Wait until Nixon is elected, and we'll get you a better deal." So the war went on for 4 more years. So there you have it. For decades now, both Democrats and Republicans' leadership is far more interested in protecting their own than being honest with the American people. But it's for our own good. You do understand that, don't you? The time, 12:27 in the p.m., the place, Nevada City, California. The radio station, KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The show is Rabble Rousing. Your host is Chamba Lane. Next one's by Dave Lindorf, smirkingchimp.com. A car dealer explains why the bailout's a raw deal. A brief conversation I had earlier this week with a car dealership executive while standing in a post office line demonstrated simply both why the banking deregulation and consolidation process of the past two decades has been a screw job for ordinary people, and why the Washington bailout has been both a taxpayer ripoff and a failure, if it was even intended to work. I was chatting with a guy standing behind me who works at one of the 14 dealerships in a Philadelphia area regional family-owned chain of GM dealerships. Noting that a number of big dealers, a Chrysler dealer and a Ford dealership, had just closed, I asked this GM manager if the problem was that the banks had frozen lending, making it hard for people to buy new cars. He laughed. "There's no problem getting car loans from the small community banks around our dealerships," he said. "They got plenty of money to lend, and they're happy to lend it to car buyers. The problem is that people are too worried about the economy and about their jobs to go out and buy a new car." And that's it in a nutshell. The so-called credit freeze is a problem afflicting the giant national and global banks, like Citibank and Bank of America, which went on a tear with all of those derivative investments and loans, like CDOs and the subprime mortgages, and which have been pushing credit on consumers with usurious rates that can only lead to default eventually. Most smaller community banks, many of them family-owned or privately held, credit unions and SNLs, which were suitably chastened by their own disastrous scandal of two decades ago, have been lending responsibly and are fully solvent and happy to extend credit to people who are credit-worthy. The big banks may be technically insolvent and in desperate need of federal bailouts, lest they go under and leave their investors holding the empty bag. But the small banks that serve most of the nation's ordinary folks have a different problem. They themselves aren't insolvent, but their clients are, or at least they're worried that they might become so. That's why they aren't buying houses and seeking mortgages, and that's why they aren't buying cars. What's needed, clearly, is not money for the big commercial banks that got greedy and ran into a ditch. It's support for the American people, so that they don't have to hunker down into a crouch and not continue to participate in the economy. When you see foreclosed signs going up along your own street, it makes you start worrying about making your own mortgage payments. When 1 in 8 people are losing their jobs, just about everyone with a job starts to have friends and relatives that are out of work, and that paycheck starts to seem pretty precarious. The hundreds of billions of dollars paid to and invested in big commercial banks that don't do much for the little guy anyway is doing nothing at all to ease the pain and anxiety amongst the grassroots. Instead, it's just being pocketed by bank managers and rich investors to be put into higher use somewhere else than on the depressed Main Street. Note that the government has put no strings on the money, much of which is being used to buy other banks or even to lend overseas. That's why all those car dealerships are folding. This brings me to that feeding frenzy of bank deregulation I mentioned earlier. The whole idea of allowing the creation of national banks like Citibank and Bank of America and Wells Fargo, and of going one step further and allowing banks to merge with brokerage and insurance companies, which began in earnest during the Clinton administration and went ballistic under the Bush administration, was deceptively marketed to the public as being good for the consumer. The come-on was that by allowing state and regional banks to merge into national institutions, and by allowing them to add investment banking and insurance operations, consumers would get more service from their banks and have the supposed advantage of one-stop shopping at the bank. Anyone who watched it happen, however, saw how bogus that claim was. I lived in New York City as it was going on, and as banks like Citibank bought up their competitors, fees began to appear for services that had no fees before, like checking and even passbook savings. Savings accounts began to require minimum deposits. CD interest rates fell as penalties proliferated, and small loans became harder to get. Some banks actually began to state, at least to analysts and to reporters in the financial press, that they were no longer interested in serving small clients and were instituting measures designed to discourage them or drive existing small clients away. Soon it was impossible in many neighborhoods of New York to find a bank to serve ordinary people. It's all been a scam. And now we're seeing the result. Banks have become so huge, and their tentacles have been allowed to reach into so many parts of the economy that all of the national ones are deemed too big to fail. Hence the outrageous bailout, which now has the government pledged to back over $8 trillion in bank debts. We're talking about a government, remember, that is itself was already technically insolvent. So back to my car dealer in the post office line. We're not going to see things get better until people are confident enough in their incomes to invest in a new car, he said. How will we get there? Certainly not by keeping Citibank or Bank of America afloat. These big banks should all be busted up, with the fragments left to compete and to sink or swim along with the rest of the nation's banks. No bank should be national in scope, and no banking institution should be able to extort federal aid by claiming it is too big to fail. Instead of bailing out the big banks and their investors, the government should be expanding and making more generous the nation's unemployment compensation program, which has always been scandalously inadequate, both in the percentage of the unemployed who are covered and in the size of the checks paid out, as well as the duration of the benefit. It should be expanding welfare benefits. It should be establishing a program to help people in danger of foreclosure to stay in their homes. Note, only the wealthy get tax subsidies in the form of 100% deductibility of mortgage interest rate payments. Those too poor to use itemized deduction get no help. And it should be establishing a major program of publicly funded jobs for those who employers have gone bust. Dave Lindorf, writing in SmirkingChimp.com. Okay, here's another one from one of my favorite blogsters, Fred Reed. What have the bastards done to my country? Thoughts in an insurrectionist vein. Oh God, it's getting worse. Everything. I knew it would. Death and taxes are no longer shots by comparison. Death and taxes are long shots by comparison. So I'm in Washington, a federal enclave, as someone said, surrounded on all four sides by reality. This was supposed to be a medical trip to have vital internal organs pawed, sliced, and injected with strange fluids. Kidneys, carburetor, remaining brain, that sort of thing. But this is Washington. Horrors everywhere. Hillary. I don't hate Hillary. She's smart, tough, sane, been around, corrupt, and personally repellent as a fang garden slug. By today's standards, that's a bargain. But why the hell is she Secretary of State? How many years has she spent abroad? What languages does she speak? What does she know about the streets of Karachi, Cairo, Guadalajara? She probably thinks Mumbai is what you eat with RC Cola. So what happened is that we're ruled by an incestuous bridge club clucking to itself in what amounts to a thermos bottle. Hillary is Secretary of State because President Obama wants to heal rifts within the Democratic Party. It would make more sense to poison the lot, but never mind. Everything about domestic politics, everything is about domestic politics, and these dismal retreads promote each other in circles. Hillary goes from governor's wife to first basilisk to senator to Secretary of State. Ah, help. Same with Cuba. The good of the country doesn't matter. We got to keep the rubes gurgling with delight. That's all that counts. The U.S. continues to make itself loathed in Latin America, in substantial part because of that stupid embargo of Cuba. Why? Because a noisy rabble of pseudo-Cuban losers in Miami votes Republican. But of course it doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks. All those funny little countries around the world really don't have anything we need except our economy, and China will give us visas to visit our industry. Perhaps. And there's this business of having a black president. It seemed like a good idea. We've had white ones forever, and that hasn't worked, so a black one made some sense. We now have established that a black president is exactly like a white one. Next time, maybe a Melanesian or a Lao? I hoped Obama would stand in the Rose Garden and holler, "You blue-eyes mofos got it all wrong, and I'm going to unscrew things." Nope. Smart guy. Decent guy. Guy you could hoist a brew with and tell dirty stories. But it's business as usual. Same tired hacks. I think I know why. Inexperience. Ponder his relation to the five-sided wind tunnel on the Potomac. I spent 30 years covering the military, and I know all the Pentagon songs. Obama doesn't. He missed Vietnam, wasn't in the military, hasn't had much to do with generals or soldiers. It's not his fault, and it isn't a character defect, but there it is. So in walks PowerPoint Petraeus back from bombing weddings in Afghanistan. PowerPoint is impressive. I've never met him, but I've met plenty with identical units. Erect posture, firm handshake, carefully deferential enough, but you can just tell he's strong and reliable. And he can sling the lingo. I love it when you talk that way. He can sling the lingo with the stern honesty of an overgrown Boy Scout and the guile of a serpent. And he's patriotic to the gills, and he's got charts. And Obama doesn't know better. So Afghan brides will continue to need Kevlar dresses. Meanwhile, things get loonier on the street. I went to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore from D.C. by train, and so help me, they're doing the same garish security theater on trains that they do at airports. Cops and German shepherds everywhere. To buy a freaking commuter rail ticket, you need a photo ID, and they type heaven knows what into a computer. Okay, suppose I show up at the obedience training window with my suitcase full of Semtex, buy my ticket with my own ID, or any ID with the balding ugly mutt on it. They barely look at it anyway, and blow up the 907 train to metallic sawdust. After the fact, they assemble my shards, check the computer, and determine that it must have been Fred. This miraculously brings the dead back to life. Bet you didn't know I had such powers. None of it makes sense except as a Pavlovian conditioning. Every few minutes, a tedious recording plays in stations saying to call some number if you see suspicious behavior. Blah, blah, blah. No one pays the least attention. No one writes the number down. Has anyone ever called it? I want to report suspicious behavior. Voice, annoyed at having the Redskins game interrupted. Yeah, what? Well, there's this, like this guy, he has a funny-looking raincoat, and he keeps, looking around, and I think his left hand is twitching. Yeah, tell him to stop twitching. What if he, blows up or something? What am I, your mother? I don't get it. Something is happening to this country. It still has a lot going for it. Friendly people, great dinners, good blues, country bands, widespread availability of illegal drugs. But the government is out of control. Everything is illegal and watched. Who wants to live in that kind of world? Today I went up to the hill to see the new visitor center. As usual, cops everywhere, squad cars parked on sidewalks, steel, stop them cars, plates rising from streets. People don't seem frightened, but the government is, or pretends to be. The visitor's center turns out to be underground at the Capitol. It's said to have cost 761 temporarily deflated green ones, and has the mental fingerprint of Albert Speer all over it. It's huge, drab, squarish, monumental, without even being imposing, with the elan of a K Street office building. I don't get it. This is the country that produced Peggy Lee and Tampa Red and the 57 Chevy. The country that spits techno-whiz golf carts onto Mars just like it was even possible. That brought the hamburger to gorgeous, bejuiced perfection and invented most of the modern world. It's the home of Sandlot Baseball and Little Peggy March and BB Guns and Tasty Freeds. It is, in a phrase, one fine place. So how did it sink to being a proto-Soviet surveillance state that builds vast, awful visitor centers in the style of a Hitlerian mausoleum? You can't go to the John without a photo ID anymore. Something ain't right. That was Fred Reed writing in his blog. There was a caller. There isn't now. If you call, I'll answer the phone. Otherwise, I'm on to the next article. Okay, on to the next article. Here's an interesting one, a conspiracy theorist with a positive solution. It's by Ken Adachi. He titles it The Great Depression II, Are We Being Played? I'm getting too many indications from mainstream media and from the internet that the coming Great Depression II is being excessively hyped, and I can't help but feel it's part of a plan, covert psychops, intended to demoralize and depress the public into believing that it's going to be far worse than the Great Depression, and there isn't a damn thing that anyone can do to stop it. So the subconscious signal is to pull up the gangplank and hunker down and spend your remaining money on storable food and ammunition. We all know how Illuminati minions like Greenspan, Paulson, Bernanke, Bush, and the New World Order sellouts in Congress worked hat and glove with their pals in the international banking industry and Wall Street to manipulate the economic collapse into place, with the $850 billion Wall Street bailout only being the latest straw added to the break the back of America. But the looming doom that's being played to the hilt on radio and TV strikes me as being too coordinated and too orchestrated. It's similar to Al Gore's Oscar-winning performance recently on TV, explaining to billionaire Oprah Winfrey how the Illuminati hoax known as global warming is going to bring us all to calamity and ruin unless we willingly yoke ourselves to the carbon footprint millstone and throw away those damnable incandescent light bulbs and instead fill our homes with the faux glow of high-voltage, mercury-filled, compact fluorescent lighting, twisted into a cylindrical shape and fitted with a screw-in base, and just maybe fitted with a few other things that they won't tell us about. Or the equally orchestrated maneuver to put up Sarah Palin as McCain's vice presidential running mate. Do you suppose that the Illuminati planners who saw to it that she was chosen as McCain's VP didn't know that the vast majority of America was going to reject that incompetent, unseasoned boob who would have been a heartbeat away from the presidency in order to guarantee the Obama win? With the exception of Bank of America, or more accurately, Bank of the Illuminati, just about every bank I pass driving around town here in Southern California has now folded as an independent bank and has been absorbed into a larger bank, like Washington Mutual's absorption into J.P. Morgan Chase, as in J.P. Morgan Rothschild and Rockefeller, family-owned. It's not a natural unfolding of history when so many banks just fold up their tents without a peep and overnight become absorbed into a few top-dog banks. The world doesn't work that way. These, quote, failures and bank acquisitions are planned and orchestrated to consolidate economic leverage into fewer and fewer hands. It's so obvious that a child could see it. I want to interrupt his article to remind folks that if you don't believe that, look at the state of media today and how media has been bought up and consolidated, exactly as they're doing with the banks now. Back to his article. It's so obvious that a child could see it. It's unfortunate that so many Americans are so pathetically dumb and blind. If American voters had kicked out of office, say, 50 or 60% of the New World Order sellouts in the House who voted for the bailout, we would have set back the Illuminati takeover agenda by at least a decade, perhaps longer. If we'd simply replaced a majority of the New World Order House incumbents with whoever ran against them and kicked out key New World Order Senate sellouts like Pat Roberts or Lamar Alexander, we wouldn't be talking about the Great Depression just around the corner. We would be talking about new bills being introduced to cut off funding for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and possibly be talking about indictments against the top honchos in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who simply took their multi-million dollar golden parachutes and virtually disappeared from public view overnight. Americans who continue to pin their hopes and dreams upon the various top corporate hierarchies who are working hand in hand with the Illuminati to take America down are living in a fool's paradise. Corporate America isn't going to save you. The much ballyhooed credit markets, which we were told had to be rescued with taxpayer money at all costs, aren't going to save you. AIG or Wall Street derivatives funds or reckless mortgage bankers or the American auto industry or any other corporate megalith that we're told can't be allowed to go under, they're not going to save you either. In fact, they're the ones doing it to you. Except you're not supposed to know that. The way to keep America afloat and functioning is to go independent. Don't depend on a check from corporate America. Start a business. Grow organic vegetables and sell them locally, and buy overnight courier delivery. Provide a service or a product from your home that serves your local community. Start a victory garden in your backyard. Teach from home or tutor others in their homes. Make documentary videos and post them on YouTube to get your name out there, and then sell things by mail order. Use your imagination and look around to see what service or product needs to be satisfied and then provide that service or product. As the planned economic collapse deepens, the Illuminati will attempt to use access to food and water as weapons to further consolidate their power and force their will upon us. We must not allow that to happen. If enough people begin to grow their own food and sell the surplus at local farmers' markets, there will be an adequate independent food supply chain that will prevent the planners from using food as a weapon of coercion. And if enough people knew that a master water dowser can find water just about anywhere, then we wouldn't have to worry about depending on public utility sources. Similar to the hidden fact that oil replenishes itself abiotically deep underground, so can water be created underground at the interface of certain rock strata. Master water dowser Stephen Reese discovered this in the 1970s and dug many virgin water wells here in Southern California, which caused many a desert region to bloom and support housing development. Don't be frightened by all the talk of a coming depression. Get busy and get independent from the corporate rules. The author of that was Ken Adachi. Okay, companioned to that, this is from the American Free Press. Congress made mercury-based bulbs mandatory in the U.S. By 2014, toxic light bulbs will be your only choice. Okay, we got a caller. I'll interrupt this for the call. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Oh, actually, I was going to say, this is funny, because it kind of, on a Monday, you played a special about John Lennon, and he mentioned how all the good leaders of the 60s were assassinated, and how you have to kind of take life a little bit easier, and how you have to understand, you got to joke about this, and get your own initiative involved, and become your own kind of leader in your own movement around your own neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then also, they're doing the 40th anniversary of some innovations on the computer, and how NASA was the first organization to buy up all the small microprocessors in the 60s, back when they were too expensive for any private companies to be buying. And it seems that that kind of initiative towards futuristic batteries and other operations is kind of what we need instead of bailing out Wall Street and these big car companies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for your comment.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, back to this article. By 2014, toxic light bulbs will be your only choice. Beginning in 2012, you'll have to use light bulbs that are dangerous and use too much electricity because the dim bulbs in Congress said they're safer and more save energy when mandating their use. A dim-watted president signed it into law. The phase-out is to begin in 2012 with a 100-watt bulb and be completed in 2014 with a 40-watt bulb. You better buy a lifetime supply of incandescent light bulbs before they become illegal under the congressional mandate. Instead of paying 20 cents for a standard bulb, you'll be forced to buy compact fluorescent lights, or CFLs, for $3 each or more. Unlike CFLs, standard bulbs can be stored forever. David Deming, a geophysicist and associate professor at the University of Oklahoma, was shocked when he checked out the CFLs. He found that the 1,000-hour bulb burned out in a week. His replacement lasted 3 months. CFLs must be burned continuously for long periods to save energy. If left on for only 5-minute periods, CFLs burn out as fast as standard bulbs. They get dimmer as they age, so be prepared to squint. So if you stick your head in the closet for 5 seconds, you have to wait 15 minutes before turning out the light in order to save electricity. Do everything in the bathroom at once. Shower, shave, brush teeth, etc., and use it for at least 15 minutes. Outdoor motion detectors or lights on automatic garage doors? Keep plenty of $3 replacement CFLs on hand. CFLs contain toxic mercury and cannot be thrown in the trash but must be recycled. If they burst, as often happens, you must cut out the part of the carpet where the shards fell and be careful to touch nothing. And what were the dim-witted lawmakers telling each other when they passed this nonsense by overwhelming veto-proof margins? It will increase energy efficiency of almost every significant product and tool and appliance that we use, from light bulbs to light trucks. This was said by Representative John Dingell, Democrat of Michigan, chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. It was a typical flight of oratory. They argued that most energy in the standard bulb goes into heat, not light. What's wrong with heating a home partly by a light bulb in the winter months? For winter months, standard bulbs have 100% efficiency. In an ideal world, where Congress would have respect for the intelligence of their constituents, consumers would be allowed to make rational choices about using lighting devices. There are places, such as in all-night drugstores, where CFLs could be used. But to mandate them for your bedside lamp is absurd. Consumer choice is known as free market economics. In the 20th century, it became recognized as a superior system almost everywhere, even in communist China. Okay, as usual, running low on time and still plenty of articles of interest. Okay, let's see. This one's called How Is Any of This Good? Jesus H. Christ on a Bamboo Raft in a Typhoon. The author is Sam Niera, and he's writing on a particular website. I predicted that a bunch of well-meaning, self-absorbed, my shame, farce book, tweaker generation types would ultimately be disappointed by Barack Obama's administration. To date, he's basically filled his cabinet with the same pieces of human offal that Hillary Clinton would have appointed. Rahm Emanuel, Zionist warmonger. Robert Gates at CIA, two of the Bushies, who's so powerful Barack wouldn't mess with him. And by the way, Robert Gates was very much in favor of the use of nuclear weaponry. And on and on. A whore-hopping hillbilly dope sucker from Arkansas as a fill-in senator for his wife? You betcha. Is it funny now? You see, I also predicted the rise in the state, and yes, it's capitalized for a reason. Our enemy, the state, has grown beyond any resemblance of usefulness into a rogues gallery of thieves and perverts. Just yesterday, Herr Bubengraber, our so-called fascist-like governor of California, declared a fiscal emergency. Does that mean fewer cops on the street or fewer private jails being built in the state? Of course not. Their unions are full of goons and thugs, and they won't see any cuts. But as for you and me, look out. Confiscatory taxation will reach unprecedented levels, which will make a call for massive tax protests that much easier. Then the real fun will start. Fun, you say? Yeah, I think that 20,000 poorly trained, trigger-happy meth addicts with high-powered assault rifles belong on any corner in America. And golly gosh gee whiz, so does Big Bad Obama. What? What is this right-wing, foul news nonsense you preach? Here, read it for yourself from the decidedly unconservative MSNBC and Washington Post. He then gives two links to articles. I didn't bother to read the articles. I surmise that the author is referring to plans to bring some troops back from Iraq, with their mission being to quell potential civil unrest in America. Posse comitatus be damned. Is it funny now? This isn't really a left-right Republican Republican kind of thing anymore. The power of this state must be absolute, otherwise it has no raison d'etre. Get over this whole liberal-conservative paradigm as well. It was designed to keep people who ordinarily should be pulling in the same direction arguing amongst ourselves, instead of coalescing to attack our natural enemy, the state. Here's a primary example from my own little corner of the world. In 91-92, I campaigned openly and proudly for Patrick Buchanan, an old-school Goldwater conservative, and he put a hurtin' on George W. Bush's daddy, King George I, in New Hampshire. At the time, NAFTA was still a big issue, and the talk was about how the standard of living for Americans would stagnate and cheap products from abroad would flood the markets, etc., etc. Not only were most other Republicans in favor of NAFTA, they were openly hostile to anyone who spoke out against it, since GHWB was still running. Well, the only people who I met over those 8 to 10 months who had actually read the thing were Ralph Nader and Nora LaDuke supporters from the American Communist Party and the Green Party. Hello! I learned real quick that letting other people tell you who your enemies are is almost as bad as letting someone tell you who your friends are. Together, the far-right isolationists and the far-left anti-imperialists really made the NAFTA supporters sweat. We almost beat it, but your friend and his, Albert Gore Jr., made sure that didn't happen. I also predicted the astronomical rise in ammo and gun prices. Duh, things have gotten so bad recently, at least one gun show I know of had to cancel their event because no one had anything left to sell. Additionally, and I know most of you don't or won't read anything longer than an email, but for your own personal edification, may I suggest this. Reading Our Enemy the State by Alfred J. Knock. It's only 45 pages and can be read online. Finally, my last words of advice for the upcoming holiday season. If it can't be worn in harsh weather conditions, eaten, used as a tool to create something else useful, or intrinsically valuable enough to be able to barter with, don't effing buy it. Yeah, I realize your wife, girlfriend, significant other may not be cool with a sudden reduction in their standard of living. But riddle her this. Can the 52-inch plasma TV that has no electricity running to it be used for fire kindling? No, the toxic fumes from the cheap Chinese parts would kill you. Can the $600 dress from BSBG be used to prevent frostbite when temperatures drop below 30 degrees? Obviously not. If you don't have anything to trade or barter with when the local K Quickie Mart is looted or burnt to the ground, remind her that maybe it's her butt that you end up trading for food and fuel. Now is it funny? Okay, self-preparedness is its own reward, my friends. Okay, we done run out of time.